All right. There we go.
Awesome.
The the fancy Skype bells and whistles are now in full effect.
Fantastic.
So for those of you guys who don't know, because I've been screaming about the fact that I get to talk to this person again for the last 48 hours. This is Ash Gallagher. She is an amazing journalist, war correspondent, intrepid world traveler. I think in every post that I've ever made about you, the word badass shows up at some point, and I believe that absolutely. So Ash Gallagher, thank you so much. It's really, really good to talk to you, especially right now, because you know the world is trying to tear itself apart, and you've been to most of the places where this is happening.
Yeah, well, I've certainly been around to what's happening, and I'm certainly up on what's happening, and it does seem incredibly chaotic. So I certainly understand why people, especially this time of year, are feeling incredibly chaotic.
Right. Absolutely. So I mean, you know, I want to get into all the crazy stuff that's going on around the world, but I also want to catch up because you know it's been a while since the last time we talked.
I know.
You know, The first time we talked, you know, our buddy Bozen, you know, connected us and basically was telling me about this crazy girl who was, in Turkey for the Turkish coup in coup attempt in 2016, and you know, ran outside with her camera, and we got to chat about that, and you know, then you introduced us to preemptive love in Iraq, who's an amazing NGO working there. What have you been up to since then? I think it's been a hot minute.
It has been a hot minute. I'm trying to recall the last time that we actually had that conversation, but certainly I was in Iraq. Mosul had ended in July, or the battle for Mosul against ISIS, or Daesh in Arabic, had ended in July 2017. And then the Iraqi government declared that Daesh had been expelled from the country, although we've seen a resurgence in December 2017. I actually have been, I stayed kind of in and out of Iraq through about July of this past year, because there was a lot of post-Daesh stories to do, a lot of displaced people. You had the fact that there was an election in Iraq this year, which still has been incredibly chaotic for the country, because the politicians are so embroiled into their own world and their own universe that nothing is getting done. They haven't even started rebuilding Mosul yet at all. It still remains under rubble and a lot of destruction, and then I left there in August, and I've been in Southeast Asia. I'm presently in the northern part of Thailand for the holidays, and I've been sort of taking a step back, making an effort to write a manuscript or a book or something about Mosul, and just sort of resting a bit as well, which is something that I've come to deeply value, because I think that especially as a war correspondent, especially someone who's been involved in the Middle East, we don't take care of ourselves enough. Back in November, there was a film called A Private War that was released with Rosamund Pike. She will certainly be up for several awards, after the first of the year. But she plays the late and great female war correspondent Marie Colvin, who died in 2012 in Syria in Bab al-Ahmar, so not long after that conflict had started. And so she kind of plays it's a bit of a biopic memoir film. And so I think that there's been definitely a resurgence for journalists to sort of take the stage. Time Magazine called journalists sort of their persons of the year. So I think there's a focus on what some of what's happened in the Middle East. And of course, the announcement with Trump saying he's going to pull troops out of Syria. And so I've kind of been just paying attention and patiently waiting and watching and at the moment just trying to enjoy the season, because there is such a desperate need for people who do the work I do to just sort of stop and reflect and rest and let our soul kind of come down from such intensity in our everyday job, and we certainly don't do that enough.
Yeah, you know, I remember talking to you about that, you know, briefly, you know, the last conversations we were having, and I think it just gets more and more important all the time. Especially, you know, the thing that really struck me at, you know, reading the sort of the idea behind the book that you want, right? Also wanting to talk about, you know, the way that tribalism and, you know, that sense of needing to belonging can really get, you know, be the thread that runs through basically every one of these conflicts, and the aftermaths and the refugees, and absolutely the journalists that you know, go into to cover them. You know, I think most people, you know, will maybe go through, you know, like one traumatic event, but you guys are going from one traumatic event to the next traumatic event to the next traumatic event. So I'm really, really glad you're up in Thailand, you know, chilling and, you know, really, you know, honoring yourself and giving yourself some time. I think that's really critical.
I do think it's critical. I think you said the exact phrase, the magic phrase, honoring yourself. And I think that's what we all need to do, is we need to be able to honor our inner personhood, however you believe that you're made up, you know, soul, spirit, whatever you believe you are. But everything, your mind needs to be able to be honored. And that includes rest. And that includes being able to kind of come to yourself and say, okay, what are the areas where I feel maybe triggered by the things that I've been through, or what are the areas that I feel that I need to sort of pay attention to, or that I need to create a space for my own wholeness? And so many people just don't do that on a daily basis. Now, we could say, yeah, in the West, there's a lot of psychiatry, there's a lot of medication that goes out there, but there's not really, I think, a lot of reflection on just the self. And I think that that's really, really vital. And I think when people are so involved and so entrenched in traumatic events like war and tribal societies, you don't really think about the self that needs to be taken care of. You think about the need of the tribe. And what happens with the tribe is, when the tribe is at war, then you are constantly integrated for the need to participate in that war, whether it's, you know, some sort of local struggle or national struggle or global struggle, you are constantly associating yourself with your tribe. Even in the journalist business, we do this. We as a journalist tribe are constantly trying to stay relevant. We're in some sort of, even if it's friendly competition, it's competition with one another. There's constantly this need to sort of stay on top of things and participate. And you sit there and say, you know, someone said to me the other day, I don't have time to take care of myself because I have to be fill in the blank, working, get the next story, get to the next fight, do this next thing, accomplish these things. And so then we just forget entirely about our own inner being, and that tribalism can actually take over us. And so and it becomes a much more unhealthy way of living. And so I think that you know, in my own life, in my own headspace, there was a need to sort of shift that. And you know, that doesn't mean that I stopped being a journalist. It doesn't mean I stopped doing what I do, but it means I need to actually take legitimate time to consider myself and come to myself.
Yeah, I really, really love that you're doing that. And, you know, I get the sense too, even just in what must be a microcosm of that kind of thing. Any time that I have sort of forced myself or been forced to, and you know, being sick the last you know, a couple times this last year has really, like, because I never stop, right? Like, my you know, yeah. just my brain, not like running to every freaking conflict on the planet, but just thinking about random nonsense over and over again. When I'm forced to just stop, those are when, you know, you can actually get it's almost like you have time to integrate everything, and then you can actually come to some major league understandings that can really inform the next move and allow you to create a lot more value, or, you know, just be a lot more of a happy warrior moving forward or whatever. But I wanted to circle back to I think when people hear the word tribe or tribalism, I think that you and I understand that in the context of, you know, whatever group you happen to be in, right? If you're in a self-identified group that is sort of almost self-reinforcing, and so that could be, you know, the Kurds, or that could be Daesh, or that could be, you know, a politician locally in Iraq that's dealing with his little enclave, I very often think about it as, you know, the you look at the political factions here in the United States. You know, I think in terms of tribalism with that constantly now, because on at least one side, facts are completely and totally out the window, and anything that reinforces that tribe's view of itself just gets ramped up to 11, right? Could you maybe expand on how you see that tribalism sort of acting in the world, and maybe give us a few different examples of that?
Sure. So this is definitely something I'm sort of exploring right now, especially in my writing and just conceptually overall. But in tribe is a word that sort of, you know, it's got a couple of different roots, but, you know, it also comes from a Latin root that dealt with in Roman times, like three states, right? So it was essentially a group, right? You're talking like three or more. So now, of course, we associate that with ethnic roots, political alliance, gender, religion, creed, nationalism, whatever you want to call it. And the interesting thing is I think when we hear the word tribe, we think of words like warrior, fight or flight, sustainable group, but we aren't necessarily thinking of something that supports you. And so I've actually brought another word in to the discussion, and that is community. What is a tribe versus a community? And I think that what happens under tribe is there is an assertion of strength. There is an assertion of what I like to call divine rightness. It's in other words, my tribe is better than your tribe because the God or thing that I believe in is better than yours, whatever that may be, right? It may be some sense of nationalistic thinking. It may be a religious thinking. It may be an ethnic thinking, but it comes from a sense of giving oneself authority. My tribe is better than your tribe. And one of the things that I notice when we talk about tribe, especially when we look at things like Iraq and Syria, which ultimately shows that a basic human consciousness, the examples of tribes fighting one another. But then you have the bigger tribe, which ends up being the United States and 21 other coalition countries.
Right.
And, you know, I think what happens is we, as Americans, have this tendency to think that we are the best tribe because we are fighting for human rights. We are defending our country. We are securing ourselves. But when you really get to the root of this, it's only really because we're the winning tribe. We're the imperialistic tribe. We're the tribe that's in control. If we were losing, we might have a much different perspective. You know, this kind of touches, if you look, for example, at the Kurds, one of the frustrations right now is that the United States president has said he wants to remove soldiers from Syria. And the Kurds are coming out and saying, you're betraying us again. And they feel betrayed by most people groups that have helped them. There are some that think that this tribe of Kurds are terrorists. Turkey in particular does. There are tribes like our tribe has helped their tribe to fight against the Daesh tribe. And at the end of the day, it's the one who's winning that tends to matter, and the one who's winning who writes the history. And we are not really any different than any of the tribes on the ground. You know, I did a story, I covered airstrikes quite significantly when I was in Iraq. And, you know, one of the things that struck me meeting some of the airstrike victims was the damage that had been done by one of our planes. Now, unfortunately, those airstrikes, when they kill civilians, they turn those civilians against the winning tribe, because then that tribe is, then those people, that people group, that tribe is sitting there saying, you did not consider our innocence, you did not consider our humanity, right? Therefore, we are now angry at you. And that anger breeds militias. That anger breeds another generation of, quote, terrorists, or whatever you want to call them. But our tribe ignited the flame that created that tribe. And so are we really doing anything different than the guys on the ground? We just have bigger guns and weapons. But is our attitude really any different, in my opinion?
Yeah. That's been my worry since all of these, you know, conflicts started. I mean, we were 20 years of war, whatever the hell it is now, right? Depending on how you want to calculate it, that idea that, you know, from a military perspective, we're playing whack-a-mole, but for every mole you whack, which is a stupid sentence in this context, You're literally just creating hate. You're creating people that are gonna hate you justifiably, right? Like, you know, there's no reason why they wouldn't, right? You could completely, totally sympathize with somebody losing their family, being like, cool, well, I'm gonna figure out how to fight back. Like, as if we wouldn't do that exact same thing in the exact same.
Correct.
So I definitely want to expand on that, but I have to circle back to the Kurds. I mean, I think something that would be really, really good for our audience is being able to understand the historical context. And I do need to let everybody know, I'm sure most people know this, but when you say Daesh, you're talking about what we consider, what the media over here would call ISIS all the time, right?
Correct. That's basically just the Arabic name. Forgive me. It's literally the Arabic translation.
Perfect. Okay, cool. So yeah, we'll call it Daesh because, I mean, you know, it's that's what it is. So could you maybe give us, though, the recent history of what's been going on with the Kurds? You said, like, you know, the Kurds feel like they've been betrayed again. You know, we have essentially allied with them, you know, more than once, right? Could you maybe give us, you know, like a little bit of a historical breakdown on how the U.S. has interacted with the Kurds? And I know, you know, the Turkish government sees them as you know, kind of a you know, that terrorist group or whatever. Can you maybe give us some background on that? Because I really want people to understand what's going on specifically with the Kurds. Because again, we're basically going to leave them to get run over by the Turks pretty soon.
So here's what's kind of interesting with the Kurdish in particular is the Kurdish are considered a minority group. They sort of occupy northern Iraq, southern Turkey, and part of Syria. So they kind of got split up as a people group, you know, when the countries were developed. Now, the U.S. has had interaction with them for a long time, but if we kind of do a much more shorter history and we go to 2003, when the U.S. Invaded Iraq, what's kind of interesting with the Kurds there in particular is that a lot of the Kurds actually saw it as a liberation. For them, Saddam had persecuted them, he had discriminated against them, he had tortured them, he had slaughtered many Kurds. And so for the Kurdish people, the United States was sort of heroic at the time because they saw it as a liberation. They were very open to the United States, to participating with the United States, to actually working with the Kurds, to providing them funding, because the Kurds have kind of their own, in Iraq, they call them Peshmerga. Now, there's a lot deeper history than I admit that can get very, I feel like, inside baseball or inside politics for a lot of people. But when you cross to the Syrian border or in even some of the more northern parts of, you have other militias of Kurds. So the main military Kurdish sort of faction is the Kurdish Peshmerga. This is sort of the one that in Iraq, they function as sort of a local army, basically. But if you go further into the mountains, you go further toward places like Turkey and Syria, you're going to have a breakdown of Kurdish militias. You have what is considered the PKK and the YPG are the two main groups. They're based off Kurdish groups, and they have been militias that have been fighting in Turkey and Syria. Now, Turkey sees the PKK as a terrorist group. These particular Kurds follow a specific commander that they sort of idolize, that their group is sort of based around. There have been attacks in Turkey of PKK, sort of explosions and things like that, that you could definitely argue are maybe terrorist in nature, and isolated attacks protesting against Turkish government. And in Syria, they were largely kind of their own group. The YPG is a faction of the PKK, and the United States actually began working with them because they were already working with Kurdish militias and groups in Iraq. They began working with them and helping them fight against Daesh in Raqqa and in Syria, because they found they're actually the most effective fighters. The interesting thing about Kurdish fighters overall is that they're kind of ruthless fighters. Their indigenous group And they work very hard, and probably some of the toughest fighters in the region. A lot of Peshmerga will actually brag. They will say we hated Saddam, but Saddam knew that we were some of the toughest fighters. Saddam would say something like, "Give me a Peshmerga fighter, and I'll show you someone who can fight." And so there was this. They have a lot of pride in themselves because they're kind of. They're sort of the kids who will go out with every weapon they've got, and they'll fight. They're a female Peshmerga, so they have female units that are considered some of the toughest in the region. And so this is a group that, at least for the past 15 years, we have had some involvement with, whether it's been training them, which I actually did witness in northern Iraq in Erbil, whether it's been providing them with money for weapons and materials and things like that. So we have done that. However, the YPG and the PKK in particular, Turkey sees as terrorists. Iraq and Syria sort of tolerated them. They didn't necessarily call them terrorists. They simply just sort of tolerated them as sort of existential militias. But the U.S. has found that they work well with the Kurds, and they're sort of an underdog people group that's willing to fight. And so we've definitely provided them with a lot of resources. So the Kurds are now feeling the pressure of being left behind and having the United States as sort of their protectors. And the fact is that they were actually really key in some of the operations in Raqqa against ISIS or Daesh. So they're already starting to feel a sense of abandonment. They're already a minority in the region. And so this is something that is sort of deeply troubling for them, that this policy has emerged. I don't know if I would call it a policy, but I guess that the statement has emerged that Trump is going to remove the soldiers, U.S. advisors.
Right. I think policies are where, like, you get together with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and use some semblance of reason and evidence and then come to a conclusion.
Definitely, and that's not happening in our country right now. So
getting close.
And it is rather suspicious that Russia has come out and said they approve of this decision. That's highly suspicious.
You're right. That day, we were apparently in the Russian media. There was a bunch of things talking about the U.S. troops being in Syria illegally before Trump came out. Right. Like, just and you know, if this was a one-off. Right. Like, if this was the only time that Russia had ever had an opinion about anything about this, we're like, oh, that's weird. But like, there's like an intense multi-year pattern going on. So like, every time they have an opinion about this whatsoever, we're like, oh, cool. So he's your bitch. Awesome. That's great.
Right. Exactly. And that's the thing is they have an alliance with Syria's leader Assad, as well as Iran. And so Russia really wants to have sort of the heavy hand in Syria and wants to have the heavier influence in Syria. By eliminating the United States, Russia gets to step in and says, you know, they've sort of won the game. And then they sort of create their maybe cultural, economic, sociopolitical influence in a way that the U.S. can't if the U.S. leaves. Whether this is a good or bad thing, we could probably argue over imperialism all day long, but essentially right. that's what's happening on sort of a proxy level.
Yeah, and you know, there's been a lot of hand-wringing, you know, over here, just because it basically, you know, somebody like me is... I mean, the second that Trump makes kind of a unilateral decision and it looks like it benefits Russia and whatever, I'm like, I'm going to put my hand over and be like, hey, that sounds probably not very good. The thing that really caught me, you know, and it's through, you know, knowing that you know, you were actually hanging out with some the Kurdish people when, you know, they were doing some training to go, I feel like that connection instantaneously, and I kind of remember hearing about, like, hey, haven't the Kurds helped us a bunch of times? And then we're just going to leave them. Like, what the crap? You know, like, just how many times are we going to do this? And again, like, there's another group of people that justifiably will hate everything American forever, because they should.
Well, you're right about that. I have a British friend of mine. He tells me regularly, he said, Americans are terrible imperialists.
And coming from Brit, that's a thing.
Well, and that's the thing. And what's funny about this to me is that if you really look at it, like, Britain went into countries and colonized places, but they built those colonies up. So you could argue that what they did was right or wrong, but when they would go into a country, they would essentially take it over, and then they would build, like, they would build the country. You know, if you go to, for example, like Sri Lanka, for example, has a lot of British influence still in its government, in its, even though the British are no longer there. But then you also go to Australia, and they still have the Queen on the coin. So there's an and they're typically under Commonwealth. So the idea is that they went in as imperialists and as conquerors and as, you know, as colonizers, and they actually did something for the countries. We go in, we want all of our influence, and then we leave. And we leave people with nothing. We leave them with nothing. And on a human level, that affects people, I think, in a much more negative way, because it's a clear statement of, I am going to use you for my benefit, and then I'm getting the fuck out of here, and I want nothing to do with you. You're on your own, when those people then may be paralyzed from even being able to rebuild their own society. So, you know, for example, in Iraq, the U.S. has cut out aid. They've cut down on aid supplies, and yet Mosul is mostly destroyed because of our airstrikes, or our authorized airstrikes.
Yeah.
What have we done?
Yeah, and I think the long tail of this, and I think you're right. And so, man, there's so many directions that we can go here. I do want to drill down into your experience, you know, hanging out with Kurdish people and what happened in Mosul. But at the same time, like understanding the bigger picture, like the long tail effect of, you know, constantly going in and doing the kinds of things that you're doing, and basically destabilizing areas, and then like, cool, we're going to take our toys and go home. And then you look at what you know, Russia is doing, basically, you know, trying maybe to be better imperialist than we were, to whatever effect that's going to do. And, you know, China's, every time, the whole time we were talking about imperialists going in and basically building infrastructure, building up the country, that's China's whole plan right now, right? Like,
I agree with you.
Right? They're spending $1 trillion on infrastructure that isn't in their country.
So I read an analysis, it's been several weeks, but I read an analysis in the New York Times where it was discussing how China has actually essentially bought a port in Sri Lanka because they want to build the Belt and Road Initiative and maritime initiative that'll go through oceans and land to create trade all the way to Europe. And the interesting element in this is that the analysts essentially said, look, there are two ways to imperialize the world. You either do it through war or you do it through economics. Yep. And China is absolutely doing it through economics, which is interesting because essentially they're using a much more cunning and maybe arguably smarter method because people will want China's financial investment, and China will send the workers.
Right.
And this has already happened in Africa. Because they by sending in their workers, they sort of secure their investment in that country and their influence.
Yeah, it really seems like a cunning is a great word, use of soft and economic power. Far as spreading their influence, and they'll eventually get huge gains from that. Whereas, you know, we go in and get short term gains, and then, you know, we're just it really sometimes it feels like the U.S. is really just, you know, if you want to follow the money there, it's just Boeing and Raytheon, right? Like whatever helps them to get new military contracts for just short term, you know, and destabilize an area, maybe sell them some weapons, blah, 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 blah. It just, because what else is it, right? Like, is there anything else really going on?
Well, I mean, I think that's the thing is that we're talking about, you know, sort of certainly a Western society of the corporate making a buck. You mentioned Raytheon, for example, there was actually an article recently about one of the congressmen who's joined sort of the military committee for Congress, and it got found out that he's had some involvement with investments in companies like Raytheon, and that's actually against the rules. Now, he released a statement, said he had nothing to do with it, but his records are showing otherwise, and so. You know, I think that what happens here is you have you definitely have sort of the plague of making a buck. You know what I'm saying? And in America, we have such a corporate umbrella that sort of controls, you talked about follow the money, that absolutely controls that. And when it comes to weapons, weapons are big money because he with the biggest weapons wins the war. And this is a tribal thing. And so we feed it constantly, constantly, constantly. And that's not to say countries don't need a defense mechanism or a military or anything like that. I'm not necessarily against any of that. But what happens is when we look at the root of it, you know, the more buildup there is with we put more money into weapons and more money into offensive. You know, military rather than say defensive. The United States itself has hundreds, literally hundreds, more bases around the world in foreign countries than any other country in the world.
Yep.
So we are top of the food chain. And I think that we are missing some of the messages that come with a sense of humanity and humility in the world because we are a superpower.
Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, because I feel like I mean, just the whole idea that maybe some humility and some humanity might be good to throw into the conversation, but to like really get it.
Yeah. So look, let's talk about the fact that we are in the holiday season, the Christmas season, the New Year's season, however you celebrate it. And this is typically a time when we celebrate things like wonderment, when we celebrate joy, we celebrate giving to our friends and family, we celebrate time with our families and love, and appreciating one another on a deep level. And it's a time when most people might give to the poor more often. It's a time when people sort of consider one another more often because of the season. Like, let's step away from the commercialization for a minute to notice that most families do create a valuable space, not a tribe, but a community where they can support one another and edify one another and treat each other with extra kindness, maybe than they do the rest of the year. and so we're in a season right now where those messages, whether you're a religious person or whether you're a person who believes in, you know, the dynamics of the earth, we're going into a kind of a winter solstice time, whether you're a person who believes in just the spirit of the season, the fact is there is an element of humanity that we all sort of talk about and participate in with our family and friends during this time of year. And yet, we keep dropping bombs as a nation on people. You know, I heard a podcast recently, and he was talking about or a speech recently by a guy by the name of Rob Bell, who was actually talking about how you know, say the messages of the Bible in particular were written by people who were oppressed. Right. And so what's happening is if you're on the other side of it, if you're the guy with the chariots and the gold and the kings, you might actually miss those central themes where, you know, the oppressed people, people who are repressed or people who are a minority, of people who don't feel their voices heard. These are people who are going to call into question that authority, and they're going to sort of demand, or I feel like demand is the wrong word. They're going to command a sense of recognition for who they are. I mean, let's look at the fight that the Black community, the LGBT community has had, our brothers and sisters in the United States, to get where they are, to even get some of the privileges that they have. They have actually commanded of our government that they be recognized. And I think that what happens is when, as a military power, we are so engrossed, and as a superpower of economics and money and weapons, when we are so engrossed and so enthralled in the support of that power, we forget the everyday simple humanity that we can relate to literally everyone in the world. You and I may be across the world, but yet you and I both want to be treated with kindness. We both want to be treated with a sense of compassion. We both want to be recognized for who we are, a sense of acknowledgement, a sense of appreciation, and a sense and just have the right to live, to eat, to be able to, for families, they want to make sure their kids can go to school. They want to make sure they're safe. They want to make sure that they have a home, a roof over their head, a bed to sleep in at night, and maybe enough money for some food on the table. So no matter what background you come from, these are human principles. And when we're so engrossed in supporting big companies like Raytheon or big military efforts, to me, this ignores that humanity. It actually completely ignores it.
Yeah. This is the thing, you know, the second I was reviewing your email this morning and the way that you've described it too, you know, the tribalism versus community is, I think, a really key way to look at this insight. There's been people in my Facebook feed talking about, you know, maybe just shooting a few brown people at the border so they'll stop coming through. You see all the strife that's going on in Europe where they're actually taking refugees, because here in the States, you know, they're way too cowardly to do that, even compared to Canada. And really, if people could just stop and think about exactly that, like, you know, bringing it into Christmas is just, it's so good. Like that. Because if you sit down with people one-on-one, like, hey, is kindness good? Yeah. Hey, you know, if we could just do some simple things and make sure people had some food and, like, some relative safety, would that be good? Yeah. And removing all this freaking tribal nonsense, and the fact that you're totally right, we're dropping bombs right now, as opposed to going in and building communities, right?
Correct.
What we could be doing. And then you factor that in, like, the whole time I was reading your thing, the little blurb this morning, all I could think about was, man, with climate change, this problem is going to get 10 or 100x'd, right? So unless we start thinking about exactly what you've drilled in on right now all the time, it could get really, really ugly. Or it could be an opportunity for us to freaking grow up a little bit.
I think that too. I think there's a call, right? There's sort of a call in the earth. There's a call in the world for people to sort of stop and recognize one another. And this happens on a global level as well as a personal level. I firmly believe, I'm in a space right now where I firmly believe that we can take our interactions that we have every day with just human people in our own daily life, and we can take that, we can apply it on the global level. And so, you know, we're in a space where if as a country we support things like aid groups, if we protest against things like expensive funding for weapons and things like that, then you know, we actually have a say in it. We have a say in who we elect. And I think in November we actually showed that. I think we did a phenomenal job of going to the polls and saying, you know what, we don't actually want what you've got to offer. We want change. And we had more women that were elected more than before. We had we had Muslim women. We had LGBT women who have entered Congress. And I think that these are actually really, really positive things. And so I think that we're on a trajectory as a generation to change this, but it's taking time, because you still have a lot of those people who are in control holding on really, really tight to what they feel as we are the better tribe in the world, and therefore everyone must follow us. But yet, if we were to bring more refugees in, how much could we learn from them? How much could we actually? I mean, I go into these other countries, and as an American person, I learn more from them. We are a nation of immigrants. We didn't become America by a bunch of just, we became America by a bunch of different people groups coming together, learning from each other, and even absorbing each other's traditions. I actually heard a joke from, I think, Trevor Noah or something recently, where he talked about the fact that the most American food is actually tacos. and, you know, the fact that we've taken something from the Mexican people and we've made it our own, and now we have Taco Tuesday night or whatever. And so I think that there's an element where if we begin to recognize how we even came to be a culture, an American culture, to begin with in the first place, it reaches within our own humanity, and then I think then it actually communicates, okay, well, we want more of these people. We want more of these people to teach us who they are and how we can be better. And that's humility, in my opinion. And that's the sense of, it's a sense of service to one another. When we constantly are blocking people out, it's self-protection. It is a tribal thing. It is very self-protective because our first instinct as a human is to protect our hearts and our spaces from somebody else, right? But if you've ever had a relationship with someone, or if you have a friend or a family member, you know that the best way for you to grow is to be vulnerable, to let them in, to let them see you, and for them to allow the same for you to see them. And then the two of you can actually build on that. If you don't do that, if you continue to stay self-protective, it causes friction, it causes conflict, and you actually never solve any problems. We have to do that on a national level as well.
Yeah, I feel like that's the core of the argument around the stupid wall.
Yeah.
It really is, I think, at base. And I think that's why, you know, people are digging their heels in on it, because, you know, on, you know, what I feel like is, you know, our side of the argument, we really do want to do that. Like, they talk about wanting open borders or whatever, and nobody is saying that. I would, right? Like, why don't we actually invite people in? And as you say, learn from them, invite them into our communities, and just, you know, there's no reason why we can't grow communities like that, right?
Well, Germany did do that. Germany, right. In 2015, Angela Merkel said, okay, you know what? Come on. Now, there's a lot of people who are going to debate whether she's good or bad, or whether it was organized enough. It doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, right. she looked at the German history, which blocked people out, isolated people, and slaughtered people,
right.
And turned around and said, you know what? We're going to change that story. And she did it. And she said, all right, Syrian people, come. There are now communities in Syria that are beginning to thrive. There are Syrian people that are having a chance at education, where they went through 3-4 years where they had no education because of this war. They escaped. They get to Germany. They can now get education. They get language, right. Education. Car companies in Germany have said, look, we need more people to come to our factories, we'll pay for their German lessons. So they've invested in German lessons for Syrian people. And it's actually going to essentially help their economy over time rather than degrade it. If we could learn from that. Germany learned from its past. It said, we did something that wasn't okay. We harmed a lot of people. Let's tell a different story and become a people that serves. And by doing so, they are actually going to be better for it in a more beautiful and integrated society. I think we could actually take a lesson from them.
Amen. Like, I feel like we're, you know, in way too many circles around here, we're taking the wrong lesson because Nazi flags are starting to show up. Oh, which is like, Jesus. What the fuck? Like, come on, man. Oh, dude. Talk about opposite sketches. Yeah, what Germany is doing now. And yeah, it's not going to be without challenges, but it's such a diametrically opposed thing to the isolationism that is sort of winning right now, right? And never mind that you're right. I think the tide is turning there. You know, like the tiny group of white male power that has sort of dominated Western culture, at least in the United States, still is diminishing, and they know it's diminishing, yeah. And all the trend lines show it's diminishing, and they're fucking freaking out, right? Yeah. There's a reason why they're stacking lifetime appointed court positions that are all right wing, and it's around that, right? Like, they're like, how do we maintain as much power as possible, and we'll fuck with voting rights, and we'll screw with this, and we'll screw with that, and it really is it's a defensive action that's gonna fail, and I think even they know it's gonna fail.
Well, and I think you touched on something that's very interesting, because this is a self-protective behavior, right?
Right.
This is a behavior that is, we are losing, and I'm of the belief that disruption is necessary in order to progress forward. And so the fact is, there has been a disruption. There's been an incredible disruption in our society. Where the sort of, I don't know, cis white male with money has had so much control for so long, and you have enough people that are fighting back and saying, no, we want to be inclusive, not separatists. We want to, but it's going to bring the separatists out. It's going to be the ones who hang on that are going to hang on and that are going to hold tight for as long as they can.
Yep.
Because they think that they can preserve that. But in the end, it is going to change. And that gives me some hope. That gives me some encouragement to say, look, it has always changed. If you look back into the 60s, if you look back in the 1960s, there was a disruption in the society. You had people who were sort of, they were protesting against war. They were protesting women's rights. They were the civil rights movement. There was a constant disruption across the culture to the point where they actually took a president out. Now, we may have some different problems today, but I think one of the similar things that we can look at is that it takes this disruption. It takes the protests and the changes and the voting and the speaking out. And it even takes the sort of internal war. Like, you almost need that fight for society to shift and change, because you are always going to have the old who's going to strive to hang on, and you're always going to have the new that's going to keep pushing forward like a tsunami and say, no, we've got to make it different. We've got to have a change. We've got to be different. We gotta be new. We gotta act new.
Yeah, I agree. And it takes waking people up enough to get them out of their regular, you know, daily patterns and daily lives to actually, you know, express an opinion and go to work on these things. Now, honestly, the second that, like, 5 minutes after it was cleared, the morning after Trump won, you know, I remember saying, like, this might end up, this could sound weird, being a good thing, because if Hillary Clinton was president, y'all would just go back to sleep.
Right.
You know, like that, and they all, you know, the vast majority of these issues for people that, you know, are on the margins of society, they're going to still more or less keep going. Probably not quite as bad. Actually, let's face facts, not anywhere near as bad. But, you know, like, they would still be around. Whereas now, you know, Indivisible is up in arms. The Women's March is world breaking. And apparently they're going to do a repeat this year. You know, like, it. Things are moving. I think just to say simply, I think you're right. You know, that having the you know, the drunk pigeon knock all the chess pieces off the board might you know, will, well, and again, you know, never let a good opportunity of crisis go unused, I guess, right?
Well, and that's the thing. Maybe that's the benefit of the Trump presidency, is it got people off their ass and woke them up. And as a journalist, I think as journalists have done the same thing too. I think that there has definitely been a complacency in the media industry for a really long time. I do think that the fight now, like, there's an element where the fight to sort of make sure that people see that we are still relevant, that we are still important, and that what we're doing is we are trying to create stories possible, is making people rethink and restructure media and journalism. And that's not really a bad thing for my industry. Like I said, I think, you know, there has been, in the past 2 months, there's been a resurgence of why journalism is important. You know, because you do have the Committee to Protect Journalists that's put out their reports of the number of dead, the number of jailed, and they're starting, you know, the United States is actually starting to come up with the number of offenses, right? Because the committee, the CPJ, they basically will report on, like, the offenses of various countries against media. And the United States has risen in that over you know, the last couple of years,
but right, like, we're on their shit list, basically.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is absolutely the government, you know, the constant fake news, the constant banning people from White House, you know, sort of White House press briefings, the constant calling the media the enemy of the people. You know, that kind of stuff has sort of made, I think, even the media realize, okay, we've got to restructure this a little bit, because now our job is really more important than ever. There was something in the Time magazine piece that I really appreciated, where there was one of the journalists that said, we don't actually want to be the story, but right now we have to try and show you why we're not your enemy, why we're actually your friend. And it was something along those lines, and it was brilliant to me, because it was basically stating that we're not out to actually be the story, but, you know, hang with us. We're not your enemy.
I mean, Trump made it the story, right? Like, the whole idea that, and again, I think this goes back to the idea that, you know, bringing the fact that, like, the journalists are the story. I think that's entirely true. Is now you have a situation where, and I love the fact that, especially if it's happening overseas and globally, the idea that the real fake news, right? Like every single time he lies, he's just going to say fake news because everyone else is telling the truth, right? Like that's how you know.
Right.
Yeah. Every time he uses the word fake and news put together, that means that everything else he just said is a lie and the news is actually telling you the truth. Right. So he's, you know, it's helpful hints that way, right? Like every time he uses a number, you know, it's wrong. Like it's also really, really good that way. But thinking in terms of the fact that now the idea of, I mean, every time he uses the phrase enemy of the people, like the hair on the back of my neck stands up, right? Like, that's appalling. I mean, it's obviously appalling. And it's exciting to me that you know, there could be that journalists can get together globally, right? That you can create a group and a community that can push back on that and be like, hey, motherfucker, no, that's not how any of this works, right?
But I mean, it also shows his lack of understanding of our First Amendment. And I do fundamentally believe in our First Amendment.
Yeah.
And I do believe that, you know, the fact that there was no law to be made against a religion or lack thereof, or freedom of the press, is very important. I've been in countries where you have actually state media, right? Like it's called, CCTV is Chinese media, or you have RT, which is Russia Today. This is state media. So you actually have this, media that is controlled by the messages of the government, and there is censorship. Right. Even in the Middle East, you have this. In Lebanon, it's most interesting because each political party kind of has its own media group, which, you know, theoretically you would say, oh, okay, well, this is somewhat of a freedom of press, but not really, because they're controlled by, you know, this party, that party, this party. And at the end of the day, the truth is actually somewhere in the middle. And in the United States, we do actually, German media is actually very similar. There's actually independent media that has the absolute freedom. Now, we could sit here and say, oh, well, they're controlled by corporations, or they're controlled by this person or that person. There's lots of names thrown out, you know, from George Soros to Rupert Murdoch and whatever their roles may be. But fundamentally, there is an element of media that has the freedom to say whatever it wants to say. And right. And there shouldn't be a law against that. There shouldn't be, there should be the ability for people to be able to report on the government. Basically, our job as the press, what our job is to hold authority accountable. That's our
right.
job.
Yep.
In my opinion.
And well, sometimes I think you're right.
And that's the essential. That's essential to keeping our democracy in check, in my opinion.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even a libertarian, you know, and I think their ideas are basically ridiculous. But for any group larger than 200, but at the same time, like the one thing they always talk about in a free market is that, you know, if a company or if a government does anything wrong, well, everyone's automatically going to know about it, and then they'll do the right thing. Except for the fact that they would never automatically know about it unless there was a free press that had absolute access to everything, absolutely.
Right.
So, right. Around I think that the locus maybe, or the focus or flashpoint is here, you know, around the enemy, the people thing, and obviously there's been a number of stories around that. I mean, up to and including like sharing a video that got sped up of Acosta karate chopping that lady. Like, it's just. Did you see that? Like
I did.
They shared
a video.
InfoWars, for Christ's sake. Like I was watching live.
It was clearly doctored.
It was clearly
doctored. Because when you see the original, when you watch the original video, you're like, but that didn't happen.
Right.
Like, at all.
Right. Right. I was watching it live, and I was like, the second that I saw the White House released fucking video. And then we find out it was from InfoWars. I'm like, oh my God, they sped this up so that it's a karate chop. Because his arm just dropped, right? Like, it's incredible. So, like, all of that crazy, nonsensical shit is going on. And then, seriously, like, you know, there's 28% of Americans that believe literally anything these people say, no matter what. He can contradict himself in 24 hours, and they're on board. And that's the scary thing, right?
And it's a cyclical cycle here, right? Because, and I was actually just going over this with a friend, but the idea is that what happens is in an age, particularly now, where you can doctor video, you can doctor photos, you can do all this kind of thing, there's a bit of a cycle here. People will sit there and say, well, it's the media's fault for doing this, that, and the other thing. Well, I'll say, but the people also want it.
Right.
There's people want to believe what they want to believe. people tend to gravitate towards someone that they agree with more often than they do someone that they disagree with. And I think that's a bit of a human condition thing, because it goes right back to tribe. It goes from your sense of identity and wanting someone to be part of your tribe. And in that tribe, you feel like you have a sense of solidarity and security. And as a result, you don't have to be vulnerable. And so I think that's what happens. And it happens on the right, and it actually happens on the left, too.
Yep.
I think it comes just back down to our desire to feel self-protected and our desire to assert authority.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I think it's going to come up way more before it taps down. And I think it comes basically back down to the confirmation bias, right? A couple of podcasts for listeners that I want to share out. Radiolab actually did an amazing podcast. I'll put in the show notes around the idea that not only can you doctor audio, but you can doctor video now. And you know that technology will be widespread within a few years. And I'm waiting for Trump to use it, right? I mean, it's such a perfect opportunity for him to, you know, say something out loud on video and then come back and say, no, I didn't, and then have video about it, or just say that video is doctored or whatever it is. I'm kind of amazed he hasn't done it yet. And that's going to cause a really, really awful wrinkle to a situation that's already way too muddy. But then to your point, you know, Chris Hayes has a podcast out, Why Is This Happening? And he talks about the information crisis where, you know, the information that we're getting and that we're receiving and that we want really is funneled through this tribal lens. And, you know, he talks about, you know, the right-left divide here, and that all of the institutions that have traditionally been filters through which we can get information that we can trust, right? Whether it's the scientific community or whether it's journalists or whether it's, you know, whatever it is, right? These communities that and institutions that were developed specifically to provide better information with rules and stuff, the right kind of lost all of those in the divorce. You know, like they get Fox News, which has no journalistic ethics or patterns whatsoever. They get, you know, they basically tell you that science is completely and totally nonsensical, right? Like and again, I'll put links to these in the show notes, but it really expands on exactly what you're talking about. Like the idea that tribalism is now, you know, the far too strong a force in the ways that we get information and the ways that it gets manipulated. And, sure. You know, being able to bring that back to I think the core takeaway that I want people to really leave this with, you know, what you're talking about as far as community versus tribalism, again, is a perfect way to boil this down. We could be talking to each other about, you know, more kindness, more inclusiveness, learning from each other, as opposed to, you know, fucking fake news, right? Or the wall.
Well, and I think that's the thing. I think the sense of inclusiveness, I think is really, really important to our world, because we are so divided, we are so easily separated, and the idea of community is about inclusion, our sense of consciousness and wonderment in the world is often about inclusion. You know, we talk about, for example, you know, Christmas, different people have different beliefs about it, and you know, everything from Santa Claus to Jesus to whatever. But at the end of the day, what's interesting is that this is a season and a holiday that actually includes several different traditions, right? I was actually listening to a podcast a little bit ago where the person was talking about, an anthropologist was talking about the fact that, you know, a lot of the Christian tradition that came from the Middle East got included with some of the original indigenous Celts into the Celtic Earth tradition. So the whole winter solstice idea, the idea that we have a winter solstice, the idea that we have, you know, when sort of Christmas, this sort of time of sort of darkness and being able to sit with what life and creation can come in the darkness. The analogy I used the other day with someone was that, you know, a child in the womb grows for 9 months in darkness, and then it comes out and it sees the light for the first time and its eyes change. But all of these traditions in this particular season were several traditions that were included from several different places in the world. And so that concept, because we celebrate that concept each and every day during the season, we have to apply that to our politics, to our daily life, to our communities. And I think that if we do that, we're going to find ourselves in a much more beautiful space to celebrate one another, celebrate our differences, celebrate our diversity, rather than separate ourselves from people who could actually teach us incredible things.
That is an absolutely beautiful point. The idea that we can choose it, like we're allowed.
Yes. Yes.
Right. That's on the table. We could go down that road if we want to.
You know? No, I think you're right. We can choose it. We have a choice. We have a choice every day whether or not to be inclusive or not. And I think that the former is certainly the better option.
I completely agree. All right, I have to swing back around to a couple of things that you know, we touched on briefly, but I think
yeah, of course.
Expand on. So you know, I still want to talk about your experience with the Kurds and before they went into Mosul. But I think we have to talk about. Could you talk a little bit about Khashoggi and how, you know, journalists are just talk to me about Khashoggi. What's your sense of that whole situation?
Well, he's an interesting guy. So I've only ever had one conversation with him. I actually interviewed him a few years ago as an analyst for another piece that I was working on at the time. Okay. And he, you know, he is someone who has become highly respected because he wasn't afraid to be critical of the Saudi government. He is Saudi. He went to the United States. He was working as a columnist for the Washington Post. So he was reporting in a much more analytical kind of space for Washington Post. Sure. He had, you know, been engaged to a Turkish woman, and he wanted to make sure he had all the paperwork for both Saudi and Turkey, and which is why he went to the consulate. So for him, it was really actually just about his personal life. He was going to sort of take care of paperwork for a marriage to a woman that he loved and fell in love with. And he'd been living in the United States. He wanted to be able to bring her back to the U.S. So, or I think she may have been actually in the U.S. at this point. But the point being is that, you know, this is a man who was not afraid to speak out when it needed to be, when it came to political problems in Saudi Arabia, for which there are many. It is a monarchy. The crown prince. It is highly believed that he was involved. He didn't like the things that Khashoggi said, and that he actually ordered his murder. We've had our intelligence service actually come out and say, yeah, this has actually happened. The problem is that we have a president who, frankly, doesn't actually care. He cares about money.
Yep.
He cares about his corporate benefit or the corporate benefit. And ultimately, when you've got a government with a lot of inherited, rich, wealthy money, you know, that speaks far more volumes than the rights of one journalist. The problem with that is this is a guy who is living in our country under our umbrella and taking refuge in our space. And so when we say we don't care about one guy, that actually makes it very dangerous for even American journalists.
Yep.
Because it means that not only does our government not care, it also means that journalists, like people like me who live overseas, it makes it dangerous for us if other governments want to pick us up.
Right. I mean, talking, you know, I'm talking to somebody who literally got picked up in Turkey. Like, wait, yes. Like, you know, would that be different now? Right. I mean,
I would worry about it, right? Because he has a really strange sort of budding relationship with Erdogan. Like, he sort of respects strongmen like Erdogan, but yet our relationship with Turkey is very dicey, to be honest with you.
Right.
So I don't know how different it would be. I definitely think that what got me out of the situation that I was in 2016 was, one, there was actually a Turkish man who sort of took charge of myself and another woman that was there, and he kind of helped, you know, helped kind of navigate around the game for us. But I also think there was that sense of humanity where it's like, I gotta call my family, because they wouldn't have let me call my embassy. I remember the guy wanted to put me in jail for 5 days, and I said, then you need to let me call my embassy, and he goes, no, I don't.
Wow.
And so, you know, this this is a country already that sort of is very nationalistic in its own way. And so when you have a situation like, you know, the Khashoggi situation, and you have a president that doesn't really care, people like me, if I were to be picked up by some sort of group, there would be real, there might not be any sort of negotiation. Look, there are hundreds of diplomatic positions in consulates and embassies around the world that haven't been filled since he took office.
Yep.
And this was a problem under Rex Tillerson. And this continues to be a problem. And so when you don't have the diplomats in these places to actually do the job and create good relationships with other countries, you have American expats who may live there for whether they're a journalist or an aid worker, whatever they are, and it makes it very difficult to actually function in the world. Our reputation goes down a drain with a situation like Jamal Khashoggi's death and basically ignorance of our own government.
Yeah, I mean, just you nailed it, and it's such a simple point and so horrific that he just doesn't care. Like, that's like, oh, cool, whatever. Like, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. It doesn't matter. And the message that sends, I mean, we've been talking about this constantly, right? Like, message that has to send to the rest of the world, to every other, you know, MBS-like person out there. I mean, you know, Russia's known for killing people all over the place anytime it wants to. You think it's going to feel constrained right now?
No, not at all.
Like, it's bananas. And I mean, you know, we're sort of in impeachment watch, you know, worst case scenario, it goes to 2020 and we absolutely crush this motherfucker with the polls. So, you know, eventually we'll get this stuff squared away. But the damage being done is kind of epic.
There's definitely quite a few damages that are being done, and it basically just shows incompetence, in my opinion. At the fact that so many people either keep getting fired or are resigning from his government, it means that he is slowly losing anyone with any sense in the government. Yep. And that's really, really scary, actually. But I don't want to focus so much on how scary it is, because I do see a grassroots of people. I think November showed that. I think people went out and voted. And, you know, there were definitely ups and downs across the country. But, you know, I think the fact that we now have congressional leaders who are more diverse, and you have states who are becoming more diverse, and that there was such popularity even for candidates who lost that sort of exposed some of the discrepancies in these states. I think these are actually all positive things, because it means that preparing for the next election can actually be a much more fruitful experience.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's even with, you know, we had a couple of really amazing women lose for county commissioner in Pasco. I mean, it's like, it's deep red. You know, we might as well be the Confederacy around here. But the very, very next day, the sense was not like, oh, no, we lost. It's like, cool, let's get to work. Right.
Yeah.
Like, we got two years till the next one. Let's get it done. You know, like that. And I feel like that's a sense that has really been engendered all throughout the country. Like, oh, cool, like, we made historic gains. And you're exactly right. Like, the places, even the places where we lost, it was really, really close. And it was all around a much more diverse and challenging kind of dynamic than what we've seen in a lot of those places beforehand. So you're right. You know, it is really, really messed up. But there's, you know, the countervailing force of inclusiveness and diversity is definitely growing up steam. So, okay. I can't let us, you know, finish before talking about, I mean, you actually went and hung out with, you know, the Kurdish people before they went into Mosul. Like, I really want to drill down into that. Like, I want people to, you know, as much as you can, be able to come away with this kind of, getting a real sense of these people as people, as human beings that are, you know, dealing with something very, very real that we're now effectively going to abandon.
Well, I lived in northern Iraq. I lived in Erbil, which is in the northern part of Iraq. It's about 2 hours or so from Mosul. Mosul is actually considered that their government typically belongs much more to Baghdad. And so the Kurds have kind of a sliver of northern Iraq. So I spent a lot of time, obviously, in the Kurdish part of Iraq, because that's where all the journalists were. And it was much easier for us to get in and much easier for us to be able to report from there. So I lived and breathed with Kurdish people. I broke bread with them. I had meals with them. You know, I think one of the stories that I sort of keeps coming back to me, and it's probably one of my favorite moments, is when I went to a small town called Batnaya, and it was in the northern part. It's north of Mosul, and it was actually the Kurdish Peshmerga that had taken Batnaya. They had defeated ISIL in Batnaya. They had rescued the village, and so when I went there, we actually had a Kurdish commander that was that took us in, and it had been just days since they had liberated the village, and he took us into the church. And the church itself was completely desecrated. You had the statues of Jesus that were broken. The Mary had been beheaded. There was graffiti all over the walls. There was even Allahu Akbar, which means God is great, was actually written on one of the columns. And it was a place that Daesh had used as their base, right? They used it as a way to sort of be their central command when they were fighting against Iraqi forces or Kurdish Peshmerga forces. And one of the most interesting things I noticed is that the cross on the church had been sort of haphazardly put back up. It was sort of wrapped around with a bunch of cloth and rope. And the Kurdish Peshmerga told me, they said, we're the ones who put that back up. Now, these guys are Muslim.
Right.
The majority of the Kurdish are Muslim. And they, I remember asking him, I said to the commander, I said, why did you guys make such an effort to put the cross back up on the church? You know, I said, can you explain this to me? And he goes, look, the Christians are our brothers and our sisters and our soulmates. We want them to come home. And this is a Muslim man, right? And so this idea to me was a sense of unity. This idea was a sense of humanity.
Community,
exactly. We want them to come home. We want to bring them home. We love them. They're part of us. They're one of us. We don't want them to stay away. And so rescuing this place was really important for us. Every time I sat with a group of Kurdish people to ask them their stories, they were so open and so warm and would invite you to dinner. And, you know, and they were funny. I mean, they laugh at themselves on a very deep level. And I really love that element of them. I remember one time being in a marketplace with a friend of mine, and we were walking down the marketplace, and he was taking pictures, and I pointed to this particular Kurdish guy, and he was actually digging his nose, and and it was kind of funny, and he got caught, and he laughed about it, and you know, in the end, we ended up, you know, my friend ended up going over and talking to him and, you know, got some vegetables from him and stuff like that. But there was just this sense of joy and laughter over the silliness of what had just happened. And I think that no matter where I went, you know, that there was always they just received me. They received people. You know, I went into the mountains and spoke to some of the smaller militias that were sort of guarding where you would consider sort of the Iraq and Syria border area, and they would share their stories about, you know, how frustrated they were, that they felt even alone at times, but they really believed in their cause. They really believed in being able to be a free Kurdish people. And you know, politics aside, there just was always a sense of gratitude on the part of the Kurdish people, and mm-hmm. and that's something I genuinely appreciated about their humanity.
So what happened in Mosul?
Well, in Mosul, the interesting thing with the Kurds is that the Kurds actually never went into Mosul Central. They weren't allowed. Okay. They had an agreement with Baghdad in particular that they would, there was a certain perimeter that the Kurdish Peshmerga would fight along. And then the Iraqi army would go further in because, again, Mosul was part of Nineveh province. And Nineveh province on the map is kind of in the north and is controlled by Baghdad, essentially. So it's considered kind of the Arab Iraq portion of the country. So the Kurds were not actually able, they basically took care of a lot of the villages and towns that were on the sort of eastern, sort of south, north, and eastern side of Mosul. And then once they got to a certain point, their job was to pull back, and the Iraqi army sort of went further in and took over.
Okay.
But the U.S. did support and supply the Kurdish Peshmerga. I think at the time, Ash Carter was in charge, and he had actually, there was that he had made an announcement that they were giving, a few $100,000 to the Kurdish Peshmerga to actually help support them because they didn't really have enough training. Right. There was also, we also have a base, the U.S. has a base both in Baghdad and in the north part because they do work with their Kurdish partners, to fight against other militias that are in the region.
Do you have any sense of what's going to happen next there?
It's going to be interesting to watch. Obviously, we haven't left yet.
Right.
Some of the PKK and YPG militia fighters, they are surrounded by enemies at this point. They may continue to go forward and fight. And the interesting, complicated thing is that while in Iraq, the Kurds actually have kind of a federalist system in which they can sort of function as sort of their own semi-government. They don't have that in Syria and Turkey. They're very much on what Syria or Turkey claims to be their own territory. So it's a bit complicated at this point. I kind of wonder if the U.S. really will remove all of its troops.
I've been wondering that too.
I mean, I kind of wonder. I mean, look, the generals are smart. The generals know. And the generals who are on the ground would have to, I believe, at some point reach your Joint Chiefs of Staff or reach Trump to actually say, you know, look, we can't actually leave them because our national security could be at stake. Daesh is clearly still, it's more than just the governments of Turkey or Syria to worry about. Mm-hmm. Daesh is clearly still in Syria and Iraq. They don't have as much territory. They lost their two main cities, Raqqa and Mosul, but they are clearly there have been sort of isolated explosions, bombings. There have been shootouts. There have been mortars. There have been people who have been affected by ISIS in the country, and so. So it's not really like the fight is entirely over against ISIS. And it does worry me that Trump would say something like that, but I have to have some hope that our generals are smart enough to say, look, if we abandon this, it might be a little more World War III than we'd like it to be.
That's been on my mind as well, that basically, you know, there was an example, around Syria when, you know, I think there was reports of chemical weapons or whatever. And, you know, Trump basically said, cool, we're going to just bomb Syria into the Stone Age. Right. And Mattis basically turned to one of his aides and said, we're not doing that. That's not how the government is supposed to work at all. But it really shows that, like, this guy is a clown who has no fucking idea what he's talking about at all. And, you know, the Pentagon, you know, really is in a position to just ignore him.
Right.
You know, or like, cool, yeah, Trump, we'll get right on that and then slow walk it. I mean, I'm sorry, it's going to take about 15 years to get 2,000 troops out. So sorry.
we really haven't left Afghanistan.
Let's be honest. Right.
And we actually never left Iraq either.
Right.
So for all the times that the presidents have said, you know, even under Obama, we've left this place. No, we're actually still there. We actually still have soldiers who die there sometimes. Right. So... I think it's a little more it's a figure of speech. It's about looks and advertisement and to act like we've done something or accomplished something.
Right.
When maybe that there's still a lot more going on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in less than 24 hours, Trump said both that we defeated ISIS and that also Russia and Syria are very unhappy that they're going to have to fight them on their own.
He's like, watching too much Fox and Friends. So, and they're a bit out of touch.
Is he ever watching too much Fox and Friends? Holy macaroni and cheese! Yeah, even just the idea that, you know, just over the last couple of days, right? He wants to, the shutdown entirely was manufactured by talking heads on Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, right?
Well, and the, I mean, here's the thing, though, too. Trump said in the very public meeting that he had with Pelosi and Schumer that he was more than happy to shut it down. He was going to take responsibility for it. I'm like, all right, well, in a very public meeting that you can find on NPR or any other news organization, he very publicly said he had no problem doing it because he wants his way, which, you know, is problematic because that wall ain't going to happen.
Right, 100%. Well, and he tweeted yesterday that the Democrats own the shutdown now.
Okay.
Yeah, like it's just like, does anyone really not see that coming? Of course.
Well, and that's the thing. The comedians are going to have fun with us, and I have to applaud our comedians in the States for sort of taking the role that they have in a pretty subversive way. And I think it's rather interesting to see their commentary usually afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, that's what else are we going to do, right? It's laugh or cry, and laughing is more fun.
Exactly, I agree.
okay, so. Thank you so much for doing this. I always feel like I come away with a much better understanding of the world. And not only that, like the having the through line that we can just choose to be better. You know, we can choose the things that you know, it seems like we are choosing, but I think the more we talk about it in those clear terms, the better chance we have of sort of winning, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you.
But maybe before we break this off, I would like to know, since you're in, you know, Thailand, sort of honoring yourself and getting some rest, what is the most peaceful moment that you've experienced there, you know, in the last little while?
Well, I'm a water animal. I'm a Cancer. So for me, anytime I'm by the water, so for a while I was down by the ocean in the south. I'm in the north, and one of my favorite spaces up here is a place I went recently hiking where there's lots of waterfalls. And each and every time I'm in one of those spaces, I definitely feel a place of sort of peace and tranquility and sort of rest and wholeness. I think just any time that I'm around the water, there's a sense of that. And I have such a deep appreciation and love for nature in that way. Nature kind of helps me come to myself. So I would say there's been multiple moments of that. And it's usually when I'm by some sort of body of water that the earth is producing.
I like it. I like it a lot. Is there anything that that you want to talk about that we haven't touched on yet?
All I would say is I would encourage any one of you that's listening to just consider where you are right now. And even if you think that you've had a rough year or a rough season or a rough moment, and your first instinct is to bang your chest and fight, maybe don't. Maybe sit with it. Maybe consider that choice of how you want to be loved and loved that way. Because that's what's going to bring us to a much more peaceful place of communion with one another. We abandon the tribal fight or flight sort of mentality. And I know that it's hard for a lot of folks out there, and it's not easy, but when we sort of embrace our humanness, I think that we're much more vulnerable and much more accepting of others, and we find ourselves even being loved more in that space. And so I would just encourage anyone, whether you're a journalist, whether you work in an office, whether you work in a factory, whether you don't have a place to go this Christmas, whether you, I don't know, whatever your situation is, whatever job you have, you know, don't be afraid to sort of come to yourself and take care of you.
Yes, ma'am. thanks again for chatting with me and for doing the work that you do. It's a big deal. It really is.
Well, you're absolutely welcome, and it's always such a pleasure to connect, and I'm so glad we had this opportunity to chat.
Indeed. Indeed. All right, well, how about this? How about you go find a waterfall to sit next to? I guess it's nighttime, so maybe not.
Tomorrow yeah, I'll get
tomorrow.
Out.
Tomorrow is good. Tomorrow is good. And I'm gonna be not sure how we're gonna release this. I think we might do it live. We might, you know, release it as a standalone video. We might do all of that. I'm really excited to share this perspective with all of my peoples.
I'm excited too.
Yeah, we'll keep you posted for that. And I can't wait for the book, man. That's get that done. That's important.
Inshallah.
Right? Absolutely. Does that mean God willing?
Yes, it does.
Nailed it.
Nailed it.
So worldly.
I love it.
All right, sister. Thank you again. I'll let you get some sleep.
All right. Well, you have a really wonderful weekend and have a really wonderful week yourself. And thank you again. I really appreciate the chance.
And hey, Merry Christmas.
And to you, Merry Christmas.
All right. Have a good night.
Ciao.